for Hype and Nonsense. As live as they want to be from California, here's Sean and Jen.
Yeah, it's Hype or Nonsense. We're not the most hated podcast in pods.
Because if we were, we'd be getting a lot more comments, I would think. They wouldn't be good comments, but, you know, yeah. They'd be comments.
Pretty obvious that we're going to have to start taking some really hardline opinions in order to get more feedback. So we're going to start now. Episode 1, greatest movie ever. Welcome to Hyper Nonsense. We're the podcast that comes to you straight from the heart of California. How are you doing tonight, Jen?
I'm tired, but I'm here.
I was telling you earlier that you should just go nappy booze time.
But that's not going to fix it. I slept for like 12 hours and I'm still tired. So,
you said that if you take a nap, you're not going to wake up and feel less tired. And I said, well, you won't feel tired while you're actually sleeping.
Right, but I won't actually be doing anything useful while I'm sleeping, so, yeah.
Well, whatever. We're here doing a recording a program.
Mm-hmm.
And we have so much excitingness of things to talk about.
We have stuff.
And the first thing, though, is we have to talk about my exciting new headphone clip that Jen engineered right before we started recording.
Right, yeah.
Because I said, because I have this, these headphones that I wear while we record the show have this really annoying curly cable. And I don't know when in history they decided it was a good idea to make these curly cables, because they really don't add anything. I don't really understand the purpose of them, but you can't usually get a decent pair of headphones for doing audio production without these stupid curly cords on them. And the problem with them is, if you can't sort of ground them, they just sort of flop all over the place.
And so the cord was flopping against the mixer and making noises.
Yeah, it was
every
just
time
banging
moved,
around
right.
and banging mm-hmm. around. And I said to Jen, because she has, you know, a background in arts and crafts.
With no supplies and making something out
and
of nothing kind of thing.
If it were me, I mean, I was looking at it going, okay, I could get one of those, I don't know what you call them, those like staple nail type things with the, it sort of looks like an H, you know, and you sort of put it in.
I could
probably just, you know, take some screws or whatever and kind of screw it in there and try to make like a little holder for the cable.
Right, and he's telling me all this and I'm looking at it and I just go, pipe cleaner.
So Jen goes and gets a pipe cleaner and she wraps it around it and places it under the mixer and
mm-hmm.
it's pretty much
and it's
perfect.
Fine. Yeah, what I did was I just took a regular pipe cleaner and then I took the center of that and sort of twisted it over the curly cord. And then I took the two ends of the pipe cleaner and I stuck them underneath the mixer so that it weighs it down. And there you go.
Boom. It's our new segment, DIY Podcast Improvements. So there is one slight problem, though, that kind of causes my OCD to go up a little bit. And that is that, you know, usually I move the headphones around. Like sometimes they're plugged into the mixer, sometimes they're plugged into the computer. So when I go to move it,
you just take the pipe cleaner off.
Yeah, but my obsessive side,
you know,
wants
you don't
there
even
to be
have
a
to,
permanent solution.
You don't
solution.
Even have to take the pipe cleaner off of the curly cord. You can just take it out from under the mixer and then shove it back in when you're going to record again.
Yeah, well, we'll see. But it's working now, so we'll see if it holds for the entirety of today's program. So let's talk about some things. The first thing that we'll talk about is, earlier this week, Jen, as I suspect most of our audience knows, Jen is a freelance writer. And Jen was published in a very prominent online publication.
That makes it sound like it's the New York Times or something. No. But it is well known, but it's not like, you know, it wasn't the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or anything like that.
No,
I pitched an article to XO Jane, which is a website that spawned from the Jane magazine. If you're as old as me, you'll remember that from when you were a teenager. It was like a magazine for teens or young women that wasn't Cosmo and wasn't all about boys and makeup. It had like some real issues in there and stuff. It was pretty cool. And it's now a website called XO Jane. And so I had this article I was going to write, and I thought, well, maybe they would like it. And it turned out that they did. So now I've got an article over there. And I think the whole title's pretty, they made the title kind of for me, you know, based on the topic, and that's cool.
Yeah.
You know, that's what editors are for. But it's over there, and it's under their, it's kind of, okay, they wrote it under their section, It Happened to Me, but it exists under their section called Issues. So it's kind of in, you know, it's hard to find, but they featured it for an entire day, so it was up for that. But the full title is, I reported an online video game player with a rape name, which is about as accurate as you can get, I think. And it's about an experience I actually had. I was playing Hearthstone, and I got matched with a player who named himself Told to Rape and went, oh, no, that's not going to do. So the article talks about just how that feels, you know, to have that just appear in front of you, and why this is a big deal in Hearthstone, because it's a game that players are extraordinarily limited. Like, you cannot just contact the player you're matched up with directly. You know, it's the game's designed to prevent that sort of thing, and yet here's this name. And then the process I went through trying to figure out just how to report that. And that's what it is, and it's over there at XO Jane, and that's the only thing I've ever had published by XO Jane, and it is the first thing I've ever pitched. So I'm pretty excited about that.
The thing that I, you know, said to you the other day after this thing went up, that I was really happy about and kind of proud of you for, is that you actually went and pitched the article. I mean, I know that you are more than capable of writing it and that your writing is good. And that's kind of understood at this point.
Well, they thought so. They wanted it. So.
But, you know, I think a lot of people who really make it in freelance, especially with something like writing, you know, there comes a point where you're probably going to have to do a fair amount of just pitching. I think that's kind of normal for how a lot of freelance writing works. And you really haven't done much of that.
No, because I think I was looking at it the wrong way up until recently. I don't know what changed. I really don't know. But I think before I was looking at like, okay, well, here's a magazine, you know, website, or here's just a regular website that covers this kind of topic. Do they accept, you know, pitched things? And, you know, what kind of thing does it look like they like people to write? Do I think I can write that? And I stopped thinking about it that way, and I said, well, here's an article I'm going to write for my blog anyway. Who wants it?
Yeah.
Who might think this is worth paying something for? And then I pitched it and guessed right.
Yeah, and that, I think, is a good way to approach it. And you've got such a backlog now of things you can link to and kind of say, hey, you know, your website covers this. I've written something similar like this, and you can just immediately link to it so they can see that you're not somebody who just sort of woke up one day and said, ooh, I want to be a writer. I'm going to go straight to XO Jane because they're popular.
Well, the interesting thing was, though, that XO Jane has a submission process. It's an online thing, and you just kind of tell them, this is what I'm going, you know, here's what I want to write about, and are you interested in this? And they got back to me really quick because they were apparently interested in this. And it didn't require me to send them links to anything I've written. And they have no idea who I am, and they didn't ask about that. They just said, oh, hey, yeah, we'd like this, and, you know, here's the amount we want to pay, and when can you get it to us? And so I said, yeah, like, right now, here you go, you know, kind of thing. And then there's a whole process. Anytime you start freelance writing with a new client, even if it's just a one-off, there's paperwork going back and forth about taxes and contracts and all this sort of nature.
Normal.
So, I mean, they did that very quickly and efficiently, so I'll give them that. And I know exactly how to invoice and when. I have information on that. And I've been paying attention to the comments in the my little article over there. In part because you're asked to do so if you write an article to, you know, comment and stuff. So I did, and I will. I think you did for about a week. And honestly, I think the comments are dead at this point, but they featured it for an entire day, like right up at the front of their site there. And it was kind of neat. And it seems they actually had an article previous to mine written by Brianna Wu, who, if you've been following anything online with women in gaming and things like that, she's one of the people that Gamergate has harassed horribly.
Yeah.
And they linked my article to hers on their website. You know, the one she wrote for them.
Right.
So I thought that was kind of like, I'm being linked to someone who's really, like, known for all this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of interesting. And so far, nobody has cared to leave, like, you know, a Gamergate kind of harassment, you know, comment.
Yeah.
So I suspect that nobody's found it, you know?
Possible, yeah.
Or I'm just not that important, or they don't care. I don't know. But it was mostly encouraging comments. You know, there wasn't anything that was very discouraging about it, you know? So that was kind of pleasant, you know? And it's a good site. I mean, I've read the site before. I used to read it on a regular basis, and then I lost track of time and kind of fell off. But it's got some good stuff. And it's from, you know, I remember the magazine from when I was a teenager. And, you know, so that kind of makes me feel like this is, you know, something worthwhile for me to pitch to. And it worked out.
Yeah, so we'll put a link to that in our show notes if anybody wants to go read that. So one thing I want to talk about here real quick, because it was, I think, briefly mentioned on the show recently. But we now have our internet here through Charter, and I just wanted to bring this up because I think I had mentioned before that we were going to switch internet providers, and the technician came out, and he said that there was a bunch of bees.
Oh, yeah. He's like, I can't do it. There's bees.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I told the story, but if I didn't, real quick.
Mm-hmm.
I ordered internet from Charter. They're our local cable company. Now, we had DSL through AT&T since forever, and I wanted something faster, so I ordered Charter internet. It's the only alternative that we have to AT&T. And the technician that was going to do the installation came out, and he said, well, your cable here, you know, the cable that needs to come into the house is old, and it needs to be upgraded. So I'm going to have to go out to the, you know, the equipment that we have up on a pole and run a new cable. And he said the pole was next to a tree, and that the tree was apparently full of bees. And,
yeah.
You know, he's just a guy who came out in, you know, jeans and a work shirt.
He's not, you know, got the whole beekeeper space suit going or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. So he said, you know, I don't feel really comfortable climbing up, going after this equipment with all these bees. And I said, that's fine. You know, that's understandable. You shouldn't have to do that. And it wasn't like the minute that I contacted Charter, I canceled the AT&T. I couldn't do that. So we still had internet. It wasn't a huge deal.
Right.
And he said, I'm going to contact my supervisor, and then someone will get in touch with you to reschedule. And a few days later, I get a call from the Charter call center. And the woman on the phone says, well, it looks like your installation didn't happen. I was just calling to reschedule. And I said, yeah, I was here, but bees. And she put me on hold, and she came back, and she said, well, we're going to go ahead and reschedule the installation, and we'll make sure that, you know, whatever is going on with the bees is taken care of so we can do the installation. And, you know, the next week, another guy comes out, a different guy, and he's here for maybe a little over an hour, and he does the whole installation. You know, no problem. He runs the cable outside because it needed a new outside cable. It needed a new inside cable. There are in this place a couple of leads from when there was some kind of cable, probably television here before, but we've never had cable television since we've lived here. So we never used it. So I didn't know what it was, if it could even be used. Didn't matter since the technician had to run this brand new cable. And, you know, he ran a cable and put an actual jack in the wall because the other cable was just sort of comes up out of the floor. But in this case, we've got a nice little plate with a coaxial jack on it. And he installed the Charter cable modem. And I told him when he showed up, I said, well, I've got a router. I don't know if you're allowed to connect to my router. He said it's not a problem, which was good. Because Charter will essentially rent you a router if you don't have one or if you're kind of dumb and you don't understand.
Yeah, but if you have one, I mean, then you don't need
that. Since I know how these things work, when I placed the order, I just went, no, you don't need to, you know, I don't need to pay extra money for your router. And the technician even said, oh, yeah, that'll save you some money.
Oh, good, 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 good.
Good deal. But, and the other thing, too, is, you know, with AT&T, and I don't know, the same thing may happen with Charter if I ever have to call for any kind of service or support. But with AT&T, what they were able to do is if you had any equipment beyond their modem, so if you had a router on the other side of their modem, they could see it. And they would basically go, well, if you're having trouble with the internet, it could just be your router, and we really can't give you any support. So the couple times I had to call them for support, I had to disconnect the router, plug the computer directly into the modem. So they couldn't say that. Anyway, I don't know that Charter won't be the same way, but at the very least, you know, they didn't freak out when I said, hey, I got my own router. So that was nice. But the guy gets the modem set up and we hook it into the router. And the router that we're using is an Apple time capsule. So it's got a 3 or 4 port router in it, and it has the Wi-Fi part of the network as well, and it has a disk in there specifically for backups, Time Machine backups, network attached storage, you might call it. So we, you know, hook it up and try to get out to the internet on my iMac, and it ain't working. We restart things a couple times, we look at some settings, and it just ain't gonna work. So I said to the guy, well, let's just plug the computer directly into the modem, and if the computer can find the internet, then we can just assume it's working, and you can go about your day, and I'll make everything else work. So we do that, and after a couple of tries, boom, it's working. And it continues to work. So he just kind of says, all right, cool. And I say, thanks, and he's leaving, and he goes, yeah, you know, these Apple things are like kryptonite to me. I don't really understand. He actually said that. So funny.
Now, did he have any problem with the bees?
He didn't say word one about the bees. And I asked him, I said, you know, the guy, we had a guy out here last week, and he said, you know, there was bees, and he just kind of shrugged it off like it's no problem. So I don't know if, I don't believe that the first technician was lying about the bees.
Well, maybe the bees moved or something.
But
I'm thinking
that either one or two things happened in the interim. One of them is, Charter came out here and did some kind of remediation. They came out here and looked at the situation and they went, okay, the beehive, we can see the beehive, it's on the pole and it's our pole, so we're going to have to remove the bees. And they did whatever they do to do that. Or it's just a matter of that, you know, the bees moved. I mean, bees do that. They may have found something very interesting that day that was near Charter's cable pole. And they were swarming it, and they were done, and they went on to do something else that bees do. But I asked him about it, and he didn't seem to really know anything about it. So, but, you know, so the Charter guy leaves, and I've got my blazing new fast internet, but one problem is it's only working on one computer, and we have three, not to mention my iPad. So we have four devices that need internet, and only one is actually getting there. So I disconnect everything, shut it down, turn it all back on, plug the router back in, and try and try and try again, and I can't get it to go. And one thing I did was I swapped out a cable that was connecting the router to the modem, and that seemed to, from that point, at least my iMac after that would connect to the internet. So it's possible it was just a cable that in that short period of time went bad because it was working earlier in the day. Stranger things have happened. But the other problem was Jen's computer wouldn't connect to the internet. And nothing I could do would get it to connect. It just wouldn't, you know, it was working on our local network. It just wouldn't connect to the internet. And I looked up a bunch of things online and nothing was, no fix that I tried to put in would go. So finally I said, well, one of the things I was planning on doing was upgrading your computer to Yosemite. So it's time. Because the only thing I could think of really is that your MacBook had picked up some setting from the old modem from AT&T, and it just, it wouldn't, no matter what I tried, it wouldn't reset itself. So I wiped your hard, you know, I moved all your stuff off, mostly all of it, and I wiped your hard drive and installed Yosemite from the, you know, a fresh installation, ran all the updates, and it was fine after that. So I don't know what happened. And now the other weird thing is we've got a friend that likes to call us on FaceTime, which is fine.
Yeah, no problem.
But before, it always worked, and now it won't work. And today I was talking to him on the phone. He called me, tried to call me on FaceTime, and you know, the app pops up and it tries to connect and it never connects. And again, I tried a bunch of things. I looked up online, couldn't find anything. And today he called me on FaceTime, didn't work. So he called me on the phone. And while we were talking on the phone, I changed the connections around again and plugged my iMac directly into the cable modem. And I asked him to call me on FaceTime again, and he did, and it worked. So this means that the problem there is actually with the router, and it's all Apple stuff, and that's the frustrating part because usually Apple stuff just works. So I don't really know what the problem is there, and it's not a huge deal because I'm not making a lot of FaceTime calls, and while you've done some Skype calls, so Skype is working.
Yeah, it's
working.
So
it's just some weird, it's just some weird thing, and it's just one of those annoying things, but the other thing I wanted to say is, you know, with the DSL from AT&T, we were getting about 6 megabits down and I think 512K up. So, yeah, not super fast. And as soon as I was getting the internet working here under Charter, I went to speedtest.net. And speedtest.net said we were getting 65 megabits down and like 4 to 5 megabits up, which is obviously a huge increase. And I heard someone say that the ISPs generally will fast lane the more well-known speed test sites out there. So you're not getting a real accurate indicator of your internet speed. So I looked for some alternate sites and I tried a couple of those and they said that we were only getting 15 megabits down, which obviously is only about a quarter of what Speedtest was saying. Now, it's still more than twice what we were getting from AT&T, so it's still, in its own way, an upgrade. But it just made me wonder, you know, who can I trust here? And I'm not really going to complain about it so much because it is faster, and, I mean, we can see day over day how much faster it is when you just go to download things. And we're not hitting that big problem that we were having before where when one computer would go to download stuff, it would just lock up the entire internet connection. You know, we had a couple of times where one of us was downloading a large file, like an installer for a game or something, and the other person could still use the internet. And before that was not
possible.
That
wouldn't happen. There were times where like I would be, you know, I'd have like a bunch of windows open as I'm trying to write something. And all of a sudden, I couldn't access things, and it turned out that his iTunes had, you know, started downloading. He didn't even know it, but it had started, and so that blocked me from accessing, you know? And that doesn't happen now.
Yeah. So, I mean, overall, it's an upgrade. It's an improvement, and I guess I won't complain for now, but I am curious about these varying speed test things. And ultimately, there's really nothing to be done about it. You know, if I call Charter and tell them, they're not going to do anything. I mean, there's nothing really that they can do. I can complain all I want. They're not going to come out here and, you know, give me a direct node just for myself.
Yeah, right.
But based on some of the reviews I've seen, because I was really apprehensive about doing this, and about every 6 months, I would kind of get this bug in my brain to do the internet switchover. And I would go online and really couldn't find that many resources of people who were really using Charter internet here where we live. But there is a Charter office, and a lot of people were using that on Yelp as a place to complain about their actual, you know, coverage and service from Charter. And we live in a college town. So what that means is there are pockets around the city where there are these dense populations of people who are using the internet. And obviously, if you've got a bunch of student housing in your area, and they're all using, you know, they're all using cable modems, and they're, you know, routing them and splitting them God only knows how many times, especially now with Wi-Fi, you're going to have a problem with congestion in your area. And thankfully, where we live, while, you know, I guess there's potentially a lot of homes here that might connect, we don't have situations where, you know, you might have an apartment, you know, an apartment building with 10 units in it that's housing potentially 40 people that are all using Wi-Fi at the same time. So I kind of thought, okay, well, I bet a lot of these complaints where people are saying, yeah, you know, I'm getting 3 megabits down, Charter is overselling its nodes and all that, probably wouldn't be a big problem here. And so far, it's worked out. So I have canceled the DSL, and we'll see. We'll see if it goes on. Anyway, it's enough of that talk.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been referring to
many previous episodes we've been saying, yeah, there's this thing we can't talk about, but we will talk about it, but we can't talk about it now. Well, we can talk about it now.
Yeah, so here's the story. We've kind of hinted about this legal thing that we've been going through really now for about as long as we've been doing this version of the podcast, because we had our initial consultation with the attorney like the first week of June. And I think we started the show, you know, within like the first 2 weeks of June. So it's pretty much been ongoing now for, well, for 6 months.
Yeah, it just feels like a really long time.
And I know, you know, people hear legal and they probably get a lot of ideas in their heads. And thankfully for us, the situation is not necessarily severe. It's not good, but it is necessary. And I guess the big reveal is that we are filing bankruptcy. Now, bankruptcy, again, is not the furthest, craziest legal thing that can happen. But the reason we were being cautious about it is just that
It just seems smart. It just seemed like a smart thing to do is to not be, you know, talking about it online and on social media in a direct way and all of that, so that, you know, any whoever's involved with the case can't go look it up and be like, oh, see, and use it against you, you know?
Yeah, because really, from my understanding of things, and certainly I'm no lawyer, but, you know, because what happened is, and I mean, we've talked a lot about kind of how screwed our financial situation is. And really right around that time, right around June, I was looking at our finances and I just kind of went, okay, well, we're really at a point where we've got these bills and we really can't pay all of them. And I tend to look at things, you know, when you're in a situation where you're sort of triaging your bills, to me, the unsecured debt bills sort of go to the bottom because, you know, food and housing and utilities and all that kind of comes first.
Mm-hmm. You know, survival needs kind of things. Yeah.
And over the years.
And in our case, you know, the internet, because that's giving us the pittance of money we are able to earn.
And, you know, in recent years, for a lot of different reasons, you know, we had amassed an amount of unsecured debt that was really more than we could hope to really service and or pay off.
Right. But the majority of it wasn't things like we didn't go out on a spending spree or something, and we didn't, like, you know, go to Vegas and gamble a bunch of money and put all that on a credit card somehow or anything.
We did go to Vegas, but
We didn't gamble. I mean, we gambled maybe $20 total, you know, but I mean, it's like a series of unfortunate events got us here, and I'm not talking about the children's books, but you know, like, we moved here, we got the house, we were told that we found out it needed a lot more repairs than expected.
Let me explain this, because I'll do a little better job than you
probably
will. Not that you couldn't do a good job of it, but I think I can place it in a little more of linear terms.
That's probably true.
But the thing of it is that when we moved from Illinois to California, which we did in the summer of 2005, we came out here with about, I mean, certainly more money than I've ever had in actual cash. It was somewhere between $10,000 and $11,000.
And some of that was because I sold the condo.
Yeah. And, well, we sold it.
We sold the condo.
Both our names were on it by that point. But, yeah.
Yeah, I think they were.
Yeah, there was a condo in Illinois that we lived in, and we sold it. So,
because we were moving here.
Right.
And I had a job moving here. My job transferred.
And as I think most people know, I'm legally blind. And because of that, I do qualify for Social Security disability benefits. And by that point in my life, because of how Social Security had been calculating my benefits, I was getting I was getting a decent amount of money per month. Now, when I say that, I want you to understand that it wasn't enough money that you could really live off of it alone. But with that money and Jen's income from working at the evil bookstore, we could support ourselves okay. And figuring, you know, once we knew that your job was going to transfer,
right?
I kind of went, okay, well, we should be able to kind of make this transition pretty smoothly.
And I mean, we did everything right. You know, we took the money from the condo with us to, you know, secure, housing after we, you know, landed, so to speak. We lived with your sister and her husband for a while, so we weren't, I don't remember if we were paying rent, but if we were, it wasn't exorbitant. It wasn't like, you know, a landlord that rips you off kind of thing. So, you know, we had that. We had family here that helped us out. I had a job, you know, that was there. We even came out a little bit early before we actually moved everything, and I did an interview, even though it was pretty much, I mean, I got there and I got announced, oh, yeah, here's the person doing this position. Okay, I have the job, you know.
Right.
So, I mean, that was all set. You know, that was about as secure as you could possibly have hoped to be.
Yeah, I mean, considering the situation, it was better than I think we could have hoped. So we get out here and, you know, we're living with my sister, looking for a place. We knew before we moved, because of the housing situation here, that we were probably going to wind up living in a trailer park. And that was just...
That's fine.
I just
didn't want to rent an apartment kind of thing.
We kind of accepted that if we were going to move, it was a sacrifice we're going to have to make. Because the most modest of homes here generally hits the market for around $500,000. And while we were doing okay for ourselves, I mean, at our best at that time, you know, we were probably pulling down, combined between the two of us, we were probably pulling down maybe $30,000 a year. I mean, it wasn't like it was a huge sum by any means, but it was enough to get us going, as it were. And we found this place, went through hell actually getting into it because the previous owners had kind of destroyed it.
They like, here's the example I like to give that really says it all. They had taken out the pipes and replaced them with PVC plastic pipes. For some reason.
That's just the not actual good. Yeah, the actual, you know, pipes that connected the
like
home
the water to the utilities. Everything. Yeah. I mean, you it was know, just it using, was PVC pipes.
Yeah, they were using PVC pipes, which you're not really supposed to do. And we had found this place, and we were looking at two different places, and ultimately liked this one a little better. And, you know, we agreed to go into, you know, escrow and everything. And once you do that, you do a home inspection. And the home inspector came back, and he said, okay,
he's like,
there's
oh my God.
All this big, long list of things.
One was the pipes. The water heater was about to blow, I think is how he said it. Yeah, that was bad. Just things like this. The furnace was dead.
The plumbing was a major issue. The furnace was old. And, you know, so we kind of looked at all that. And I told the real estate agent, I said, well, look, with all this in mind, we can't do this. So he goes back to the sellers and they make an offer where they were going to knock like $10,000 off the asking price. And the other thing they were going to do is, and it was kind of weird that they were going to do it this way. Well, they were going to do a few things. They were going to replace the furnace and the water heater. And what was supposed to happen is we were supposed to walk away from the closing with roughly $10,000 in cash,
which we could use to, like, say, replace the PVC pipes and things
like
that. Even though,
you know, we were putting in our you know, our nugget, our $10,000 as a down payment. The way they were going to work this transaction is we were going to walk away from the table with roughly $10,000 in cash
Fix all the problems that the previous homeowners didn't do.
To do, it might have been I don't remember if it was $10,000 or maybe it was $5,000, but it was enough money.
Enough to at least, you know, help you out with all the things that were wrong.
It was enough money. Yeah, it was enough money that we would be able to, you know, get the plumbing taken care of and kind of do all the necessary things you want to do before you move in, you know, painting, etc. And that seemed like, at that point, you know, and then we went through this ordeal to get financing because getting financing on a mobile home is not the same as getting it on a house or a condo.
And a lot of places, at the time we were doing it, and this was in 2006, a lot of places didn't even, what?
2005.
Oh, okay. Right. We didn't actually move in until 2006. But at that time, all the places that were going to, you know, finance homes, they didn't want to touch mobile homes. They wanted nothing to do with it at all.
So we had to find this, like, alternative finance company, and they were, I hasten to say that they were shady, but they're just, something seemed a little off about it. But anyway, through some magic, they managed to actually get the loan funded, and we could afford the monthly payments, and everything, you know, looked like it was actually going to work. And we go to sign the papers, and we're at the title company, and our realtor was not there.
And wasn't able to be contacted.
And, he did say, you know, the day before, you know, I won't be able to be there, but if you have any questions, just call me. And I had never been through a closing process before, other than I'd been through, well, I guess one sale and a couple of refinances, but those aren't really the same. And in this case, I guess I kind of felt like, well, we're going to get the deal we were told we were going to get, and we sign all the papers, and I go to the woman at the title agency, and I go, okay, well, we're supposed to come away with this with a check. And she kind of goes, well, I don't know anything about that. So
our realtor lied.
Later on in the day, I called the realtor, and he said, well, actually, what it looks like happened is, instead of you guys getting the cash, they just took that off the top of the, you know, they took that off the loan principal, essentially. So, I mean, We still got the money off,
but now we had to come up with money out of pocket to do all those repairs.
We were cash poor now, and we had to replace all the plumbing in here. So I kind of went, okay, well, you know, there wasn't really anything we could do about it at that point, and we were mentally ready to move into our own place.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The plan
was not to live with your sister's family forever. No. It was just like we're going to get here. We're going to find a place. We're going to move on. I've already got a job. It should be easy, you know?
Yeah.
And it was a good job. It was a 40-hour week, you know, benefits and all that job.
Right. And I just kind of went, okay, well, you know, at the very least, as we're going into this, we're pretty much, in terms of any debt we're carrying, I mean, other than the mortgage, we were pretty much at zero.
Right, because I owned my car, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that wasn't an issue at all.
Yeah, and we came out here... we came out here debt-free, so... The thing is that... I went, okay, well, we need to get this work done before we move in. It's kind of imperative. And found a good plumber who specializes in that kind of work. And just went, okay, well, I'll just go ahead and float that on a credit card. And I figure in, you know, probably 6 months to a year, if all goes well, we'll have it paid off. And that work, you know, all total, we probably racked up, you know, moving in here with all the necessary expenses, we probably racked up somewhere around $6,000. Not a great amount, but not an unheard of amount. And, you know, my whole plan was, okay, once we get in here and we get settled and things kind of stabilize a little bit, then I'm going to get a job, and that'll just help us, you know, we'll have more money coming in, and then that'll allow us to pay the debts off faster, et cetera, et cetera. And we closed on this place in October of 2005, and I would say by the end of November-ish, maybe mid-December-ish, we get all that other work done, the plumbing done, the new water heater put in. And we did, because our water heater was like a science experiment that was ready to explode, we actually had the water heater moved, and it's in its own little shed outside now, whereas before it was inside, it's
right.
Outside now.
Well, it's pretty standard practice to kind of have it outside. Some of the older homes have like a little cubby that you reach from outside,
right.
You know? So the problem was that they'd built an extension and they sort of like walled up the water heater, you know, behind drywall. And I remember that the plumber guy was like, I'm like, where's the water heater? And he's looking around. He's like, why did they put it behind this? And then he saw the quality of it and went, oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
it was kind of
weird, but now it's set. It's outside. It's
all
it's structurally sound. It's new. You know, it's great. All set.
Well, it is almost 10 years old.
Well,
now,
I mean, at the time, though, you know,
it was
new and it was safe and it was fine.
Yeah. So, but, you know, that required obviously extra work. And, you know, they did a complete replumb. They you know, replaced all the plumbing underneath, most of the plumbing, if not all of it inside. We got new sinks, et cetera. You know, great. And the other thing we did is we pulled out the horrible carpet and we put in these concrete floors.
Right, because your brother-in-law has a company that does those,
that,
so we knew we could trust them.
So here we are, you know, we're heading into the beginning, and, you know, we do all that work, and then we decide, you know, okay, we're going to paint, and then we'll actually start moving in, because even though we're anxious to get in, obviously you want to do all that stuff first.
Yeah, because it's just, it's really hard to paint if
you've
already got moved in. Yeah.
I'm a mediocre at best painter. Jen's way better than me.
Actually really good at it, and I find it fun, but I couldn't do it because I was working 40 hours a week.
You were working, and you were always
tired. And we weren't living here either, so it was a commute as well, you know?
And so it was hard. It took us a while to really get all the work done. And one day, it's like... within like the first week of January, I'm over here minding my own business, doing some painting, and I get a call on my cell phone from someone at the local Social Security office here who I've never spoken to before, had no idea existed. And it's common when you report to Social Security that you've moved. If you're getting any kind of benefits from them, you have to obviously keep them updated on your address. And it's common anytime that you move, they ship your file to the local office to wherever you live. And I had told them, you know, when we moved in with my sister in August of 05, I called them, you know, to let them know, hey, I've got a new address. And, you know, they're not super speedy with things. But eventually they transferred my file from Illinois to the office here in San Luis Obispo. And it landed on the wrong person's desk at the right time. Because I don't think that they spend a lot of time really going over files that are established, but my file landed on somebody's desk and she decided to look at it. And she looked at my history and she saw that I was, because I had started receiving my benefits so early in life, I started getting them when I was 18 because I was born with the condition that renders me legally blind. She looked at my file, and she saw that I was getting benefits under my parents. Well, I think at that point it was my dad's Social Security number because he had passed away in 2003. And typically the way Social Security operates is if you start receiving benefits early enough in life to where you don't have kind of a Social Security, you know, an income history of your own, because Social Security is typically, your benefits are based on an income. And if it's not your own income, then it's usually your parents'. Now, it wasn't like I ever asked them to do any of this. It's just what they decided to do. And over the years, Social Security, if I can say it, would bounce me back and forth between my mom and my dad, as to how they calculated my benefits. And again, I never asked for any of this. It was just something that they did automatically. And every time they would do that, it would usually cause a little bit of an increase in my benefits, which was always appreciated. But understand, and what the fuck, who cares? I'll give the number out. But at the end of 2005, I was getting between, if I remember correctly, like it was around $1,300 a month. So, you know, the equivalent of working a job essentially as a wage slave, and to really bring it home, I'll say that what Jen was making working full-time at the bookstore, you know, after they took out her retirement and, you know, other benefits and taxes and everything, she was actually bringing home a little less than I was. So, again, it was a nice chunk of change, but it wasn't like we were living high on the hog as far as what I'm getting, what I was getting from my Social Security.
Yeah, at that time.
And after my dad had died at the end of 2003, they had switched it back to him because they could kind of base my benefits off, you know, essentially his, you know, his remaining benefits or whatever. I don't know of any better way to explain it than that. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't really work like that, but
that's a good enough approximation, yeah, though, I think.
But anyway, and it had just rolled like that. So, okay. Early 2006, January, I get a call out of nowhere, local Social Security office, and the woman says to me, well, I'm looking over your case, and I see that you have an income history and that you're getting benefits under your parents, but it looks like you've got enough of an income history. And to be fair, you know, this was, early 2006. And in the span of my lifetime, over roughly 10 to 12 years prior, I had worked in jobs, you know, part-time jobs, a couple I had in high school, and then some that I had after that. And, you know, those were all jobs where I worked and paid into Social Security taxes, all that kind of stuff. She says, it looks like you have enough of a history here that we can actually just transfer your benefits from your parents to you. And I'm kind of going, okay, what does that mean? And she says, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to cancel your current benefits and we're going to do a whole intake on you to start over. And I'm just like, I'm kind of shell-shocked. You know, this came out of nowhere. I didn't get a letter. I didn't get anything. And with all of the other stress that had happened over the last few months, we're just trying to get into the house. I'm kind of already at my limit, and I'm just going, okay, I mean, because there's nothing you can do.
Yeah, she's not asking you, we do this? She's saying, we are going to do this. This is your only way you're going to know about it. And that was it.
So she begins to run a new application for me. She asks me a bunch of questions. One of which is, are you married? And I said, yeah. And she said, when did you get married? I said, it was July 15, 2004.
And this was 2006.
And this was now January of 2006. And she goes, okay. And she continues to process the application. And she goes, well, you know, it doesn't look like on your record that we had been notified that you were married. And once you get married, it automatically cancels any benefits that you get if you are getting benefits as a child under your parents,
essentially, yeah.
Which I had no idea about.
Right, because I'm sure it's on some paperwork that you probably signed when
you were
18.
Oh, it is, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
No, we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
But I had no idea about that. And she said, so there's probably going to be a matter of an overpayment there that you're going to have to repay. And I'm just kind of going, what the fuck ever?
So basically, what we've got going on here is we've got a debt because of the house repairs we need to do. We have a new mortgage, okay? Brand new mortgage. His income is poof, gone by, and they're telling him, and we're gonna require you to pay us money.
Yeah.
This was not possible.
Yeah. So I'm just kind of shell-shocked by all this, and I get off the phone, and I'm kind of like standing there, and you know, at the time, the cell phone reception here was real shitty, and I had to go outside. I'm kind of standing, you know, out front, and I hang up the phone, and I'm just kind of standing there in a daze going, I don't even understand what just happened. And I go inside, and I start painting again, and I'm trying to kind of process it in my mind. And, you know, eventually I get all this stuff in the mail that's kind of telling me everything that's going to happen. And it lays it out pretty simply. What I already explained about how they're, you know, effectively recalculating the way they're going to pay me. But not only that, I now owe them, because of this overpayment, I now owe them roughly $21,000. And I went, this is impossible. I mean, you can't even process it. It's just unfathomable. So I should have at that point gotten an attorney, and I didn't. And that is a regret that I will carry probably for the rest of my life. But I was dumb enough, naive enough to believe that if I went through the system, that I would be exonerated because I had no way of, I really had no way of knowing that me getting married was going to screw up my benefits. And while I have zero regrets about marrying Jen, if I had known beforehand, we wouldn't have never gotten married. And that's just, that in of itself is kind of a sad statement, but it's just the nature of reality. If someone had said to me, hey, if you get married, it will absolutely screw up your benefits. Believe me, trust me, make phone calls, verify, double check, do all this stuff, please, before you get married, please, please, please. And I knew that was true, then there's no way that I would have done it. But that's all. There's nothing to be done about that now. We couldn't go back in time. And even if we had that day decided to get divorced, it would have made no difference.
No, they still would have decided that they'd overpaid you and you'd still owe that huge amount of money.
They wanted that money back, and they were sure as hell going to get it. So I call them up and I go, well, you know, and the other thing that happens along with all this is they go, you owe us approximately $21,000. And because they canceled my current benefits and started me on a new claim, it generally takes them at least 6 months to get that in process. So now, not only do I have this huge debt dropped on me out of nowhere, I have no income. And my basis on us being able to actually move in here and live was on me getting the money I was getting and Jen getting the money she was getting. Now, Jen's money wasn't going to change. But that was effectively half of our income gone. So I start to kind of panic and I go, okay, well, the first thing I got to do is I got to get a job right now. And, you know, my plan, my hope was that we would get in here, we'd get settled, and I would be able to find a job that would really be something that I would want to do. As much as I could make that happen, because I wouldn't be under this immense pressure to take essentially a desperation job. Now I needed a desperation job. And fortunately, for the time, I guess, I found one, and that was the call center job that I had up until the end of last year. And if you go back and listen to our first episode of the new version of Hypernonsense,
you can kind of see how that
which
went.
We'll link yeah. to. Mm-hmm. If you haven't heard it, you can go back and you can listen to that, and you can kind of get the whole story on the whole work thing up to that point. So anyway, I get a job, but the job that I get, because of just all of these limitations that are in play, it doesn't really replace the income that I had lost. And now we're kind of more screwed because we needed to be at the level we were at, but we needed to be higher because we'd taken on some debt, but not only that, we had this other debt that came in. So the only way I'm looking at all this going, you know, I can't plan for anything. I can't budget. I can't do anything. It's just everything's fucked. And the whole time I'm just kind of going, okay, if we need to pay for something, we don't have any money, we'll just put it on a credit card and worry about it later. And, so this whole thing is just kind of ballooning and spiraling. And finally, in, you know, late 2006, they finally get my benefits started again. But because I have this overpayment, they don't want to pay me. They want to take my benefits until I'm paying them off. Now, we got to, and if I wanted to, I could have made a payment plan with them wherein they wouldn't take all of my benefits. They would only take some of them until they got their overpayment paid back. And I didn't want that. I wanted that debt to go away as quickly as possible. Now, the other thing that happened that was maybe good for us, and is almost more heartbreaking because it would have been so much better, is my mom, my dear mom, who has helped us so much beyond her capacity financially over the last, 9 years. It's not, I can't even, it almost makes me want to cry, because my mom is, she's pushing 70 years old, and she's got a pension from working in a grocery store, and she's legally blind just like me. And she has Social Security. She's been on, disability just like I am. And now she's just on regular Social Security because she's so old. But she decided to sell her house in Illinois.
Well, at this point, though, she really didn't have much family in Illinois.
Well, no. After we moved, she didn't have a lot of reason to stay there. And my sister had kind of been egging her on about, well, why don't you move out and live with me, meaning her, my sister.
Right. She was telling your mom to come.
And finally, my mom just kind of went, okay, I'm getting tired of the winters. And, she didn't like she was living alone in every sense of the word. And she finally decided she was going to move out here. But what she wanted to do was because I have another sister in another part of the country and some other relatives, she wanted to kind of go spend some time with them. And then she was going to move out here. She sold her house in Illinois, which she didn't own completely, but she had gained. My parents moved into that house in 98. My dad died in 2003. My mom sold it in 2007, I think. And while she still had a mortgage on it, she was able to pull some, she had earned some equity because the market was so strong, and she was able to walk away with a decent amount of money. It wasn't anything life-changing, but it was a nice chunk of change. And she gave some of it to us. She gave some of it to my sister. And because of our situation and how screwed everything was, she said, well, if you want to, instead of me giving you one check, I'll give you a little bit every month to kind of, it'll almost be like you were getting your disability benefits, just not actually getting them. And I said, that would be great. And that's what she did. And it helped a little bit, but it wasn't quite enough to get over that gap. And after, you know, a couple years, and I can't remember where Social Security started me under my own benefits, but I want to say it was like $750 a month. So immediately,
that was like, you know, half, right?
It was almost half that it had gone down. And I wasn't getting any of it because it was all going back to them so they could recoup their overpayment. Now, in that time, I was going through the appeals process to appeal the overpayment. And I'm sitting here going, eventually I'm going to get exonerated and they're going to give us all that money back. And I go through, there's like three or four levels. I think there's three levels of appeal. The first one is you send in a written appeal, which they rejected. The second one is you can go in and have a meeting with someone in the Social Security office who is not the person that originally
made the decision.
Exactly.
But it's still someone within the Social Security office.
And at that time, they actually brought out the file that showed all of these things. It's got a whole long list of things that if any of these things happen, you are supposed to report them to Social Security. And one of the things on there, and she pointed it out to me directly, is if you get married, you have to report it. And at the bottom of the page was my signature with a date. It was definitely my signature. I don't specifically recall signing it, but I don't believe that they forged my signature. And now I'm...
Oh, wow. Musical interlude for some
almost,
reason.
Almost, yeah. I was...
It's like the dramatic music before right. You, like, you know, go postal in the office or something. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, and fine. She showed it to me. Okay, you know, great. I'm still not going to back off of my appeal. And I take my appeal as high as it'll go, pretty much, which, by the way, took for fucking ever. You know, I think, you know, because I had started, I'd asked for my initial appeal pretty much straight off. It was probably, you know, January, February, somewhere in there, you know, March or whatever, as soon as I could in 2006. And like, you know, a year or some odd down the road, I get a call from somebody who goes, oh, yeah, we looked at your file and we noticed that you had requested to have a hearing with an advocate judge. We're really sorry. We're not sure, you know, why that didn't get taken care of right away, but we're scheduling it now for you. And that is more or less your last line of appeal. You can ask to go in front of an advocate judge who is, of course, working really on behalf of Social Security, because that's
right.
How these
so
things
work. So the system's rigged from the beginning. You can't win.
So
you'll never find somebody unbiased that isn't going to vote for themselves.
So I go in, and I have to go to this office here in town. And it's just an office. You don't actually go to the courthouse. And you go into a little room, and, you know, there's an advocate judge there, and he's got essentially an assistant, a stenographer, whatever you want to call it. And I go in and I sit down, and they've got a microphone in front of me, presumably to record everything. And he says to me one more time, you know, you understand that you have the right to have some kind of legal representation. And if you want to hold off, we can reschedule this in the future when you can come back with a lawyer or some kind of help. And I said no, again, because I was just kind of stupid and shell-shocked and sort of blown away by the whole thing, but also I believed in the ultimate truth of my case, which was I did not know about this rule, and the likelihood is that, hey, I'm legally blind.
How big was the font on that page?
You know, the page, you know, that I signed years and years ago, who knows if I could even have read it properly at the time. And I explained all this to him. And he goes, okay, you know, I've never really heard a case quite like this one before. I'm apt to rule in your favor, but I have to check everything. I have to go over everything. And, you know, you'll get a notification in the mail. And I kind of walked out at least feeling like, well, you know, not all hope is lost. Now, this is at a point where if they had ruled in my favor, Social Security would have been required to, because I had, by then I think I had paid them back, so they would have been required to pay that back to me. Now, if that had happened and all that money had got sent back to me, that would have been enough at that time to pay off all of our unsecured debt and have some left over, and our income would have been stable. I mean, from that point on, just looking at things on paper, we would have been okay going forward. So about, I don't know, a month later, I get this big fat, you know, package from Social Security with the judge ruling, and he says that he ruled against me, and he gave some reasons why. One of the things he actually quoted was something that I had written out in my very first appeal, and I can't remember what it was, but it's kind of irrelevant at this point.
Well, basically what he did is he said, oh yeah, you know, I feel bad for you, but I'm not going to do it anyway, and he dug for reasons why not. He'd decided before, no matter what he said. He'd already decided.
And again, this is where I have, you know, the regret about not getting a lawyer, and I know some people are going to hear this and go, yeah, that was really stupid. I'm not gonna say that I'm completely not to blame in this scenario, but I'm also going to say that the whole thing isn't completely my fault either. Now, so here we are, you know, it's 2007-ish. I'm working, you know, you're still working at the bookstore, I'm working at the call center. You know, our income has kind of stabilized, but we're now dealing with this fairly, you know, by now the unsecured debt, just due to everything that, you know, just trying to manage through all this instability, you know, is between like maybe $10,000-$12,000, and I'm still kind of looking at it going, well, you know, if, you know, we might be able to turn this around. And I'll admit that I have not always been the best steward of our finances in a lot of ways, and I have purchased things on credit when I would have been better off waiting. You know, I did a lot of things like I would see something that I wanted and I would buy it on a special promotional thing where I would get no interest, and I would always pay it off, so it was more or less a purchase like cash. But the smarter thing would have been to either save up the cash, or if nothing else, apply that back to, you know, the debt we already had. I'm really willing to say that there were a lot of times when I could have been a better steward of our finances. But also, during that whole period of time, I was kind of just, again, kind of shell-shocked by life. I wasn't really dealing with anything on a real kind of basis. And, you know, time went on, and the debt, you know, about once a year I'd look at the debt and I would try to consolidate everything to make it a little more manageable. And every year it would, you know, it never went down. It kept going up. It kept going up. And
then eventually I switched jobs. And then where you are in this.
Yeah. We're about there. Okay. And then, you know, in beginning of 2009, you went from the bookstore to working for the school.
Right. Because at that point I figured out that I couldn't physically do the bookstore anymore. There's a lot of dust, which everybody that's listening to the show knows I'm highly allergic to. And part of what I was doing now, I'm incapable of running a register because I cannot process numerical data to save my life. What I'm looking at, what I'm seeing, and what I'm saying, and what I'm handing out would be different numbers. And I know this because when I was younger, before I figured out I was dyslexic, I used to screw up cash registers, right? So about all I could do there is help people find books and dust off the shelves and reorganize, which I was really good at, but it's a lot of dust. And I knew I couldn't do that. And I'd gotten injured twice with tendonitis from lifting stuff because I was doing the bargain section, which is a lot of unloading boxes and sticking it on the sales floor. So I'd gotten injured twice doing that, and I knew I was at my limit with that one because I have a pre-existing injury from a previous job, you know, on that arm from, you know, with I popped a tendon over part of my hand. And so it was kind of like, okay, I'm really pushing this. I can't do that. My lungs are not handling it. My allergies are not handling it. And I was in pain all the time. And I thought, well, I'm in pain all the time because I'm lifting books all the time. That must be why, you know, and I'm walking around. I'm on my feet for 8 hours. That's got to be why I hurt all the time. I can't keep doing this forever. My body's not going to let me. And so I tried to find something else that I could do. And I have a teaching degree, but it's from Illinois, so it doesn't count here. But it was good enough to get me a job as a teacher's aide in a special education program in town.
Yeah. And I do want to say that for the most part, now there were other factors at work. I mean, let's be honest in that you, after, with everything that had kind of happened in the 5 years or so that you'd been working at the bookstore where...
It changed.
A lot changed.
We had a new, not store manager, but like whoever's above all the store managers come in. And this woman was not nice. She'd come here from somewhere on the East Coast shortly after being divorced. Apparently the divorce didn't go the way she wanted it to. She was out here. Her family was still in the, you know, the East over there. She found fault with everything everyone did. She fired people left and right. She would tell people specifically, tell your workers, you need to do it this way. And then you'd come in and she'd come in and scream at you for doing it the way she'd said. I mean, she was a horrible, horrible person. And she put everybody on edge in the entire store from the store manager on down. At the same time, they were starting to cut hours. They'd already done away with the full-time positions. When I came here, I had a title that was connected to 40-hour week kind of stable, you know, benefits and all that. By the time this lady showed up, the whole company had gotten rid of those positions. So it was starting to shift, and I was seeing it shift, and I'm like, they just killed the full-timers. We're never going to have full-time ever again. Yeah. And we were seeing that happen. People were getting their hours cut down to nothing. There was one girl that was getting full-time and been there way longer than me, and they gave her like 10 hours one week out of the blue. You know, I mean, It was just getting terrible. They were pushing a lot of people to go to the website instead of get it in the store.
Customers.
And so I'm like, well, if you're training everyone to go to your website, you're training people not to come to your store. This does not bode well for the brick and mortar store I'm standing in. You know, it was pretty bad. And I didn't foresee anything good coming from it. They were going heavily into just all of that kind of thing. You know, there was more benefits. You could get a better deal on the website and better benefits as a member on the website than you could in the store. You know, and they were starting to crack down on what you could order before it was, well, I kind of like this book. How about I order one into the store and take a look at it? Now they wanted like your credit card information to do it, you know, and it was just like all these kinds of things that I think were happening in other stores at the time, too. But this was dramatic. And I just could see that this was never going to be good again, you know.
Yeah. So
and I was sick and I was in a lot of pain, and it took me till years later to identify that I was starting to experience arthritis and I didn't know it. You know, so that's where I was. And so I jumped ship, basically, and I got another job as a teacher's aide in a special ed program for emotionally disturbed kids, which is about as intense form of teaching you can possibly put yourself in. And it seemed better than where I was.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, special ed teaching, nobody wants those jobs. I'll stay. There's not going to be a huge influx of people wanting that job behind me that might be better qualified. I'll just stay put. It'll be fine. And it had benefits, and it had all that. And it was, you know, right down the street. It wasn't far.
Yeah, and
it was in town, you know?
I will say, you know, while for the most part, the money you were making was mostly equivalent to the bookstore, it was a little bit less. But, I mean, you were still getting, you know, the health insurance and all that other stuff. So, you know, it wasn't a huge decrease. So you, you switched jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And
I did that school year, and then I did summer school.
Yeah. And then, so then it was, you know, it was ready. It was time for you to go back. Now, this would be the fall of 2009.
Right. And that's the point where if you are hourly, if you're a teacher's aide or any other position like that and not like a full-time teacher, even actually some of the teachers, you don't know if you're getting a contract or if you're getting an offer.
Yeah.
You might not know until the week before school starts in some cases. So it's kind of the time of the year where all the teachers were kind of like going, well, I don't know if I have a job coming. I have no idea, you know?
Yeah.
And I got it. And I was like, okay, cool. You know, so I came back, and the group that I'd worked with, that was just such a tight group and worked well together, half of them had gone to other jobs because working special ed with emotionally disturbed kids is difficult and stressful. And it was understandable. One of them came back, but there was two other people now in the classroom that we hadn't worked with before. And it didn't work out really well. And after a while, you know, when I was there the first year before the summer school, I noticed that we weren't getting any breaks. And yeah. we were working through our breaks and we were working through our unpaid lunch breaks. And I'm from Chicago with the teachers unions, right? I was never a part of a Chicago teachers union, but I know that ain't right, you know? And I got the union on them, you know?
Right.
So I didn't know if I'd be asked back, but I also knew it's special ed. Nobody wants to be in this classroom. This is difficult. If you want, you know, teaching is difficult. This is more than that, you know? I didn't figure anybody would want to be there. And one of the people that was there had been there previously and then found another job and came back. The other person had come from some other special ed program somewhere in the state, I presume. So, you know, I figured, okay, well, I'm here, you know, and it's 2009 and we're good, you know?
Yeah.
Not
well,
so much.
Yeah. And so, you know, one day, you know, out of the blue.
Well, let me back up a bit. I was supposed to get, when you start as a teacher's aide in this district, you are on what they call probation, and you have three reviews you get. One is like the first month, and then you have like a 3 month, and then you have like however many months after, right? And I got in the other two, and they were fine. And I knew it was time for my other one. And so I kept asking the principal, hey, I'm supposed to have this. When am I going to have this? You know, and oh, well, ask your teacher. Okay, ask the teacher. Oh, well, you have to ask the principal. Okay, we'll go back to the principal. It was like back and forth. And eventually the principal got tired of me asking. And she said, don't you worry about it. We'll handle it.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, okay, fine. You know, I'm just following protocol here. I figured that'd be important, but whatever, you know. And so I got a letter in the mail at home, not in like my mailbox at school, no. You know, at home, that arrived and said, tomorrow's your last day.
Yeah.
And the reason that you are being let go is because you failed to complete your last review. And I'm like, what? You know, I've been asking for this for a really long time, you know. And I'm sure what happened was the principal was pissed off because, you know, I got the union honor for doing things that were illegal and unsafe. And she got in trouble for that. At the time, I mean, I think that it happened with a lot of people because I remember other teachers saying, hey, I never get my breaks, you know, that kind of thing. And and that sort of thing. It was a pattern in the school. She got caught. She didn't like it. She actually came to my classroom door to scream at me in front of the students, you know, the students that don't handle people screaming and a change in things well. And she knew that, you know, so she was mad. She was mad. And so she decided this is what she was going to do with no warning. So I guess if the principal neglects to give you the review you ask for a million times, then that counts as not completing your review. That's all she had to do, you know? So that's what she did because she was a vindictive little nasty person who was breaking the California laws regarding breaks and payment. So that job disappeared. And I remember the next day, I'm like, my first thought, honest to God, as soon as I realized this was real, my first thought was, oh my God, these poor kids.
Yeah.
Because we had a group that every year they'd have different teachers. They didn't know who they could count on. We had at least a couple of them that had abandonment issues, you know? And I'm like, I'm just going to be gone. They're not going to see me. It's yet another teacher that leaves them. That was my first thought, honestly, which means I probably am a good teacher, you know? but that was my first thought was these kids, you know? And I went in to confront the principal because this is how I am, right? You know? And she could tell I was mad. So she made time for me in her office. And I'm like, you know, what is this about? I asked you all these times for this. The teacher I'm working with knows I've asked. The teacher's aides I'm working with know I've asked. The school's counselor who worked with our classroom frequently knew I've asked a bunch of times. What is this nonsense about didn't complete? That's your fault, you know?
Yeah.
And she just went, well, we just felt that you didn't have the skill set for this classroom. And I said, well, what is the skill set? Oh, it's a certain skill set. And we didn't feel you had the skill set. Well, what is the skill set? You know? She would never answer. So it was just her being a bitch.
Yeah.
She decided this is how to get rid of an employee that, you know, got her in trouble for doing things that were illegal. And I was irate. And you could tell. And the school counselor walked by and kind of noticed and came in going, what's going on? You know, because she was really good at crisis. And I ended up coming into her office because at this point the kids were going to be coming by the door pretty soon, and I didn't need them to see me this irate. That would not help a group that's already got trouble, you know?
Yeah.
To have someone who's in charge of them be this upset. Like, obviously that's going to set off people that have fears about things not going right, you know? I mean, It just wasn't something to put them through. So I'm like hiding in the counselor's office, who, she was a wonderful person with just like so much patience, honestly. And, you know, I told her what had happened and everything, and she was upset, but she couldn't specifically say, you know, that bitch, what did she do? You know, I mean, she couldn't do that. But I could tell she did not approve of the principal's actions and the way that she'd gone about doing things. And so she asked if there's anything that she could do for me. And I had a notebook I'd left in the classroom, and I said, could you get that? You know, and so she went and got that. And I remember her asking me, like, you know, well, what can we do? Would it help you to have the kids write you a letter? I mean, I can take the letters and hand it to you. They don't need, you know, you don't need to interact directly. And I'm like, you know, it's not really going to help me. If you think the kids need to do that for themselves, do whatever you need to do. But it's not something that I feel like I need, you know? And I mean, I was upset. I'm like crying and irate and my face is all red and you can totally tell. And this is not me normally, but I was, you know, you get to a point, I've heard it's the Irish in me, if you can't choke the shit out of someone you're pissed at, eventually your body just cries, you know, I mean, that's just where it goes. And so I'm leaving after the kids are securely away and not going to see me. The people I'm working with have no idea why I'm not there, you know. The principal at first honestly thought that I was going to go into the classroom and work that day. And she's like, well, or we could get a sub. I'm like, oh, you better get a sub, you know, because there is no way that was going to work. So they have no idea. The kids don't know why I'm not there. The teachers don't know why I'm not there. So they can't give the kids an answer. You know, the counselor, I assume, probably handled things in some way, you know, later on. And I'm leaving and I come across one of the janitors and I'm obviously upset. And he's like, what's going on? You know, because the janitors are always cool people, you know. And I told him what had happened, and he said, yeah, well, you know, they'll probably call you back in like a couple months because they do this all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God, I thought this job was going to be it, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, that was...
And I mean, there was no warning. It wasn't like they were going to say, well, we don't think you've passed this, so at the end of your probationary period of X number of months, you're gonna have to find a new job, so here, get ready. It was that day. I mean, you know, and I could tell the principal thought that that letter would not come until after I had taught that school day because she did not get a sub. Yeah. She thought she could sneak that right by, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think she's done it before because I had heard stories of other teacher's aides for that classroom and others that had suddenly disappeared, you know?
Right.
So I think that's part of what the problem was. But that was that job I was counting on, you know?
Yeah. And that
and it was in my field, you know?
Yeah.
And there was no warning. That was it. It was just gone.
No.
So, I mean, I came home stunned, you know, and I got online and talked to a friend who was very helpful and nice and filed for unemployment immediately.
Yeah.
Which and, you can do online. I did it online.
Yeah. And, you know, after the usual kind of rigmarole with unemployment, you did eventually get benefits. And, you know, however... That period of time between you losing that job and your benefits kicking in was actually the first time that I seriously considered filing bankruptcy because, again, I had a pile of bills sitting there that I couldn't pay.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually called a local attorney and had a consultation, and they did everything over the phone. And, you know, it was an education for me, for sure. And I kind of went, okay, well, you know, I'm not entirely there yet, but I'm really close. Thanks.
Yeah.
We'll be in touch.
Right.
And the next day,
yeah,
you got your first real check from unemployment.
Now, let's make this clear. I got, you know, I lost my job. I filed that day. We got a paycheck, one more paycheck from work. You know, that came in. And it took a total of between when I filed and when I finally got money, it took 38 days.
Yeah. So, you know, it was close. But when that check arrived, I went, okay, well, we're okay now. And if these checks continue regularly, then we'll be all right.
And they didn't continue regularly. They really didn't.
No,
it was a constant battle of you need another call. We're going to ask you again the same freaking questions. We're going to, you know, all these things. And, you know, I was working. I started to find work as a freelance writer. Just kind of thought, well, I could do that. So I started trying. And it was like, you know, I got a place that wanted four blogs about something, or maybe it was five, and paying individually per blog wasn't a whole lot of money. And I thought, okay, maybe I can do that. And, you know, I sent them one and they said, great, here, do four more. Okay. And I remember I wrote like the first one and I was exhausted and it took all day and it was just so draining. I'm like, how am I going to do this? And now I like write all day and it's nothing. But but at the time it was kind of like, I don't know if I understood that this is where I was going to go career-wise at that point.
Yeah.
It was just like, okay, money. You know?
And you know, it's worth mentioning too that around November, December-ish of 2009, you actually tried getting a job where I worked, and we learned after a few weeks that you weren't cut out for that kind of work.
Yeah, and they, you know, you go through training, of course, and everyone that trained me was so nice and so patient. And no one could figure out why I couldn't do it, you know?
Yeah.
And I was making mistakes like, you know, the person you talk to on the phone gives you a phone number and you type it into the, you know, computer screen and you read it off. And what they were saying and what I was typing and what I was saying, none of it matched. No one knew why. Yeah. And I eventually had to talk to one of the people in charge and say, look, I'm dyslexic and I think this is the problem.
Yeah.
You know, they couldn't do anything. But at least then she could tell others. And they would know why they were failing to train me. It wasn't them. It was just this. And I didn't know. I mean, I knew I had trouble with it. And I knew I had some coping skills. But the amount of time, like after about an hour, my ability to cope with any of it was gone, you know?
Yeah.
So I was even screwing up names at that point. And so that didn't work. So I was there for like, I don't know, training for a while and it didn't work. And then, of course, you know, now that's not on my income, you know, going into the papers you send to unemployment. So now they're asking me a million questions. Well, did you get fired? No, you know, I didn't get fired. Well, did you quit? No, you know.
Right.
Well, what happened? Well, it just didn't work out. Well, why didn't it work out? Well, it just didn't work out, you know, and you're going back and forth on this, knowing that this nasty person on the phone who doesn't like you, hates their job, and who is strongly encouraged to make sure you don't get any money from them, you know, you're talking to them, hoping you can convince them to give you the pittance that comes from unemployment to keep you alive for the next few weeks or whatever. And, you know, and whenever they make a call, whenever they're like, well, we're going to call you again, they don't just call you. They give you a paper that says, we're going to give you, you have to have this call. This is the time and day. You have to be here. If you're not here, bad things happen. And they stop sending you checks from that point on. And that assignment of the, you're going to get this phone call could be 3 or 4 weeks away. You know?
Yeah.
And this was a pattern that happened the whole time. And it's just ridiculous how they treat people like that, you know?
So, you know, here we are. It's the, you know, sort of first quarter of 2010. And you're getting more and more of the freelance writing work. And, and it's starting to pick up nicely. And, you know, we had, after a lot of stumbling blocks with EDD, we had finally kind of gotten it into a rhythm where they were sort of understanding what was going on, and we were able to, you know, you were still getting some benefits from them, but they were pretty much reduced to the point where, you know, you were getting maybe $100 a month.
Yeah, it was a huge ridiculous deal anymore.
You had really, you know, by you know, the mid to last quarter of 2010, you know, you had really gotten enough writing work that it wasn't really necessary for you to have those benefits.
Right.
And eventually,
the EDD actually tried to prevent that from happening, because when you're freelance, you're not an employee.
Yeah.
Okay. You're contract work. And the EDD decided that they, unbeknownst to me, they went ahead and tried to contact the company that I was doing the freelance writing work for.
Right.
And they contacted them and said, you have to pay her unemployment.
Yeah.
And that could have lost me that entire gig. And it was all I had at that point. And they didn't even tell me they were going to do this. So I got an email from the person that was my contact through that company that had given me assignments and all this. And she was telling me, yeah, you know, they called here and they sent us letters saying that that we have to give you unemployment. And we don't know why we got this. And we explained to them that you're a contract worker and that's not how this works. And we don't know what happened. And have they told you anything? And I'm like, this is the first I've heard of it. You know, I could have lost that gig.
Yeah.
I could have lost that gig. And it turned into, an extremely stable one, you know, for the most part.
Right.
But that could have been it. You know, the EDD could have prevented me from having the only work that I had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, 2010, 2011, 2012, just kind of roll along. I'm working at the call center. You're doing the writing thing. And, you know, for a lot of those times, you know, you were working pretty much every day.
Right. Well, I had one of my gigs wanted 5 blogs a day.
Yeah.
Like every day. So that takes some time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So anyway, I don't want to get too deep into all that. But my point is to say, you know, for the most part, our finances were relatively stable. But, you know, these things would come up. And because we were always just riding the line, anytime something unforeseen would happen, you know, car repair, house repair.
We had a bird that got severely ill.
That happened.
And that there's no health care insurance for birds.
Well,
you know?
And not only that, there was a couple of times when, you know, we had, you know, medical things that came up and that required, you know, and we had no insurance. So
right, because you don't get any as a freelancer, you know, and this is before the Affordable Care Act.
Right,
you know?
Right. So, you know, our finances, every time we hit a snag, we had to just put it on credit. And, you know, year by year, the amount was getting higher and higher and higher. And in about mid-2013, your big client that you had been working for, you know, for a couple years at that point, pretty much working every day.
Yeah.
And that's not an exaggeration.
No, it was every day. 7 days honestly, a week. It was every day. And I was fine with that because, oh my God, I'm making money as a writer. You know?
And
it was stable. And it became not stable as much. They had a portion of the writing that they required that was suddenly no longer required. And the person who was hired as an editor for that portion just found out like that day. And so she was calling the writers who were all across the country and in some cases outside of it and letting us know. So I got this email saying, oh, what's your phone number? I need to talk to you. I'm like, oh my God, what happened? You know, and that went down, but I was still getting some work from the same company. And that kind of grew a little bit, but not to the point where it was, because that's, you know, that's freelance.
Yeah.
You know, that's how it goes. I picked up another client that was stable and here and there random stuff. So I was still trying to make it work.
Yeah. So, you know, your income at that point went down. It went down by about half.
Yeah, it went down a lot.
And we obviously were not prepared at all for that. And it was just kind of like, I just kind of went again. I looked at it and went, well, we'll just roll with it as best as we can. And where, you know, when we would hit a point where there wasn't enough money, then it just went onto a credit card. And then and you know, this pretty much gets us caught up to what we were talking about you know, the first episode of this iteration of Hyper Nonsense, where in October of 2013, I applied for the job at Automatic, and against all odds, it seemed, they actually gave me a trial. And I believed that if I went into that job and gave them everything, that they would hire me on full time.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're an up and coming company and they're a good company, and based on some things I was able to glean online that may or may not be true, I really believed I was going to come out on the other side of that with a job that was going to pay me probably $60,000 a year with full benefits.
Which would have set us up fine, you know?
And that would have been next to life-changing money for us at that point.
Right. And I remember we talked about it, and you were saying that, you know, because of you're legally blind and all of that, your eyes get strained from looking at, well, really anything, but computer monitors after a certain amount of time. And you were looking at computer monitors at work, and you were looking at computer monitors at home when you were working for Automatic. And something was going to give. Like, I think you got to the point where you're like, if I could just put more hours to this, I know I could do better for Automatic, you know?
Yeah.
And we talked about it, and we knew that, you know, in some ways it was a gamble, but at this point I felt like all of my employment was a gamble. I mean, you know, I lost my job as a teacher's aide in special ed. I mean, that was about as stable as you could get, you know. And I didn't believe anything was something you could count on ever with employment ever again at that point. And I thought, why not try it, you know?
And, you know, there were other factors in play. And we talked about this a little more in depth before. But the truth is that after working at the call center for 7.5 years, I was kind of burnt out on it and I was ready to move on. And, you know, it was a matter of, and to their credit, Automatic does not recommend that if they bring you on as a contractor for a trial, that you leave the job that you're in.
Right. They didn't tell him to do this. They did not say do this. They said don't do this.
I kind of said, we're going to, you know, I want to take a calculated risk here, and you were willing to go along with it. So, you know, I gave my notice to the call center, and I gave everything I could to Automatic, and that didn't work out. And much like the experience Jen had with the school, you know, when they just out of nowhere, they said, you know, you're done, we're letting you go. And I said, why? And they said, well, we don't really have, you know, specific quotas or criteria, but just based on our evaluation, it's not really working out. Thanks.
Yeah, we'll this whole nebulous thing,
and
you know,
it's just like,
yeah.
Okay, well, and that was, you know, contract work, so I wasn't actually an employee there. And I figured there was no point in filing for unemployment because I didn't think I would get it.
Right,
and this was December
of 2013.
So just about a year ago. And so at this point now, we had gone from your income, you know, being cut in half to, you know, my income effectively in a lot of ways being cut in half. And just kind of sitting there going, well, we've got some money saved up and we'll just kind of ride this out for a little while. And I really firmly believed that one of two things would happen. And that is that I would either relatively easily be able to get another job, or that if nothing else broke loose, they would take me back to call center.
Right, because it had a pattern of hiring people again, and it had a pattern of constantly having job openings and
turnover.
You know, turnover, and you would see, like, in, you know, the local places that tell you about, oh, here's some local jobs that are open, the company would keep popping up.
Yeah.
You know?
And that was kind of my thinking. So I started to go out and, you know, apply for jobs. And I had one interview and, you know, that didn't really lead to anything. And I didn't, you know, I applied for, you know, dozens of jobs. And believe me, none of these were, you know, high profile. You know, these were all just hourly kind of wage slavey jobs. And I couldn't get any callbacks. And finally, in March, out of desperation, I went, well, I'm going to file for unemployment and just see what happens. And to everyone's surprise, mine more than anyone, I think, they actually eventually, after, you know, the usual rigmarole with them, they did honor my claim. And then, and that kind of gave us a little more of stability, but through this whole period, we're still building up more debt. And, you know, then, you know, it's, you know, now June-ish, and I'm looking at everything, and I've done, you know, some more kind of moving around of the debt to try to make it a little more manageable. And I just kind of went, you know what, we can't play this game anymore. We've got to either get to a point financially where we can really manage this debt and begin to pay it off, or we've got to stop paying it. And that's when we had the bankruptcy consultation. The attorney said, yeah, you guys look like you're in pretty good place right now to file bankruptcy. And everything just kind of rolled from there. And just due to certain reasons.
It takes time.
But due to certain other factors, he kind of said, you know, I think before we really file, you should probably wait a few months. And the other thing he said was, you know, please, by all means, if you can, stop using your credit cards, which we did. I was finding that once that factor was removed from having to pay those unsecured debts, that with the money we had coming in, as meager as it was, we could at least cover our bills. Of course, now, as I've said in more recent shows, kind of as a surprise to me, my unemployment ran out at the end of September. So we're back at a point now where we're not actually really bringing in enough money to pay our bills and to kind of get that situation caught up. You know, I have been looking for work, and I've actually had one job. It wasn't, well, I had an interview, and I went in after that to do, as they called it, some testing at this job to see if I could actually really do the job, and that's just a standard procedure they do, as opposed to kind of bringing, you know, people in and training them and doing all that. You go in and you do a few hours worth of work, and they kind of evaluate your work, and you know, that seemed like a fair thing to do, but they didn't apparently like my ability to do the job, so that didn't turn into a job. I talked to another company that had some potential, but the problem there was they needed someone to come in at 5 a.m., and I don't have any way to get anywhere at 5 a.m. because I can't drive and the buses don't run that early.
Right, I mean, I could technically drive him there, but
it would be problematic. It would be problematic, and I realize that I'm not in any position to be super picky about it, but I'm also not in a position to completely throw off my life to do, and I'm not saying that I'm above any of this, but the job would be a $10 an hour job where I would be, you know, cleaning up sidewalks, literally. I mean, that would be my job, and I don't have any problem with that. But you know, the whole starting at 5 a.m. thing wasn't going
to
work.
Right. I mean, you'd have to switch around your entire life for that. You know, you've got things that you have planned during the day that you work on now, and that you have different stuff like that, and that would take all of that away. And it wasn't enough money.
If they were gonna pay me $60,000 a year with benefits, yes. I'll make it work,
mm-hmm.
You know, because then at least I could afford taxis.
Right. You know, if you had to. But it wasn't enough. And we've tried the whole like working weird hours thing, mm-hmm. and it doesn't work out well. It's not great for your health.
No.
You know?
No.
Yeah.
So I just kind of went, you know, thanks, but no thanks. If something opens up here where you need somebody, you know, and I gave him really wide open availability for most days. Like, I'm talking like, you know, I said I could work from like 9 to, you know, between 9 and 10 p.m. almost every day. But getting there at 5 a.m. So anyway.
Yeah.
My point in saying all of this is, because I know there's people that are going to hear it and go, well, you just got to go out and get a job, man. You got to pull yourself up by the bootstraps.
Well, you've applied for more things than I can even keep track of at this point.
You know, I've got several applications out right now. I've actually got a job interview tomorrow. But as I've learned, none of this really means anything, and everything for me is kind of doubly compounded by the fact that I have a disability. So just because a job exists that doesn't necessarily require any special training, it doesn't automatically mean that I can do it the same as anyone else. And a lot of these kind of jobs I look at and I don't even know, not only that if I can do them, but can I do them safely? You know, like, I don't really think I should be, say, manning a forklift in a warehouse. That seems like a bad idea.
Well, you're not allowed to drive because of your vision. You know, the DMV is you shouldn't be doing those things.
Or, you know, other types of jobs that might require similar types of skills.
Well, in addition to that, though, I mean, even if it's like, oh, well, anybody can run a register. Well, if you can see the numbers and you're not dyslexic, you know, I mean, he's got no problems with math or anything like that. He's not dyslexic. But if it's, you know, turn your computer font down like to the tiniest itty bitty setting and then walk across the room. Can you see it?
Yeah, it's kind of like
you know
that.
What I mean? That's just how it's going to be.
You know, and so, you know, I'm applying just all these different places, and what I'm learning is that, first of all, the job market really is as shitty as everyone says. You know, I don't care how anybody wants to spin any kind of growth or recovery in the economy. I'm not seeing it from my end. And the simple fact of the matter is we're really not bringing in enough money to cover all our expenses, and we've got some support from friends and family in different ways, and that's been appreciated, but, you know, we can't rely on that forever. And I'm not ready to kind of throw in the towel completely yet, but, you know, kind of my short-term plan, because there is no long-term plan, is that if it comes down to it and I have really nowhere else to go and I can't get a job, even just make, you know, minimum wage in California is $9 an hour. But if I got a job making $9 an hour and working 20 hours a week, it'd probably be enough to at least keep us afloat. So if I can't at least get that in a reasonable amount of time, then kind of my next thing to do is I'm going to have to start selling stuff. Now, earlier this year, in lieu of having income, from work, because I had no job, I cleared out our shed and I sold a bunch of stuff on eBay that I was going to sell anyway, but it was stuff that I was, you know, I had kind of earmarked for, okay, well, we can take this and put it into savings or put it into debt, not become sort of a central part of income. And I've sold probably 90% of it. Most of what's left is not really very valuable. It probably won't get in total more than $50 to $100. It's not like I'm going to be able to sell that and go, well, we're good for another month. And
but even if you could, that's a month. You know what I mean? Yeah.
And after that, all I've really got to look at is I can look at non-essential things of value. And by non-essential, I mean they're things that we don't need in order to live and or produce other income. So that, as things stand right now, I would probably start with my music equipment. I don't want to sell it, but I will if it comes down to it. I've sold music equipment before to help make ends meet. I don't want to do it, but I will. And then after that, I guess maybe our television. And then after that, it's going to be the audio equipment. And then after that, it's going to be my computer. Because I won't have anything left after that. And
even that is not going to be enough.
And that,
you know what I mean?
You know, yeah,
even that together is not going to be enough.
If I roll, again, you know, if I rolled all that into what I think I could get for it max, you know, it might help cover our bills for a month or two. It's not going to be enough to live on for 6 months. So this brings us to a couple of things. And the first thing I want to say is, I hope that the tone of this whole thing hasn't come off of us maybe sounding overly defensive. I don't know. But obviously it's a stressful thing. And the tone that I tend to see a lot in the world is when people say, well, I'm having, you know, difficulties money-wise, everyone just kind of reacts and go, well, it's your own fault, it's of your own doing, it's your own making, and if you know, you just pull yourself, be an American and pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you know. And believe me, I'm trying very hard to do that.
And you have been for this whole time. We've just explained all of it, you know, if anybody out there. I don't think our listeners really have that kind of attitude.
Well, I don't know.
You know, but I mean, somebody else could come in and be like, oh, I've always been rich, what's wrong with you? You know,
right,
that kind of attitude.
Right. And, and believe me, again, I don't feel like I'm better than anything or better than anyone else or that I'm too good to do whatever. It's just the nature of things is that just because, you know, you can go out theoretically, and I'd actually believe it when I see it, but, you know, just because, you know, you can go out and get a job at, you know, Taco Bell or whatever, that doesn't necessarily mean that I can do it because I have, you know, a disability.
Right.
And believe me, if it gets down to that, I'll try it. You know, if they'll give me a shot, I'll try it.
But like, if that's just going to result in you being injured
or potentially injuring other people
you know, this is not a good, healthy place for you to be. You can't take a job that's $9 an hour or whatever under the circumstances where it could cause injuries, like realistically, because you can't see, you know, and expect that this is going to go well.
Right.
You know, it's just going to lead to more problems and more financial issues later on. If you injure someone else, they're going to sue.
Yeah.
If you injure yourself, you're going to have medical bills that, you know, have to be dealt with. I mean, it would be wiser to just avoid that, you know, because it's not like you're saying, oh, I don't feel like working at Taco Bell or wherever, you know, I mean, you have a disability. The government recognizes it as such. Otherwise, if they hadn't, they wouldn't have gone through all the shit that they put us through, you know, several years back. It's established. You can't fake it, you know, and it can't be fixed.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all there is to it.
So this is where we're at. And I want to thank everyone who, you know, is listening to this still. I can't imagine it's a whole lot of fun to, and I hope we don't sound like we're just kind of complaining into
I think, though, this was relevant because for so long we've been saying there's this thing we can't talk about.
Yeah.
You know? So now you have the whole thing together.
And the other thing is, I think that there is some, you know, some value in just kind of relating the story, because I know that there are a lot of people who are going through, you know, rough times financially. And I think that as a culture, we tend to withdraw with those kind of problems, and we kind of go, well, you know, we don't really want to be public with that, or we don't want to seem like we're asking for help or whatever, because...
Well, there's a stigma on it. You know, there's a stigma. Being poor, there's a stigma, period. You know, needing government assistance like food stamps or, you know, unemployment or anything
food
like that.
Is another story.
Food stamps, another story. But any of that kind of stuff, you know, there's a stigma attached to it. You know, even being disabled, there's a stigma in this culture, you know, about it. So, I mean, there's a lot of reason why people don't reach out and say things, you know?
Yeah. So the, I guess the thing we're getting at here, and, you know, we're pushing the 2-hour mark, so we're not going to try to take this on for too much longer. But what we have decided to do is we are going to start a Patreon campaign for Hyper Nonsense. And you probably are familiar with Patreon by now. If you're not, it's a crowdfunding type service that you can sign up for to make contributions to us on a recurring basis that will, you know, help us. And in this case, it isn't even so much about us trying to just monetize the show. It's about us trying to survive as human beings. And we'll have a link. What you'll be able to do is go to hypernonsense.com/Patreon. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And that'll take you straight to the Patreon campaign page. We're going to have a video there that will kind of explain everything and lay it out more. And to give you just a brief overview of how Patreon works if you're not familiar with it. You know, a lot of people, when they hear crowdfunding, they think of something like Kickstarter, where you're trying to kind of pool a bunch of resources to do one specific thing. But in the case of Patreon, it's more about kind of making a pledge, an ongoing pledge over time. And really what it's going to break down to is we're going to set it up so that you can make a pledge per episode. And I mean, you'll be able to pledge for as low as a dollar. And in fact, you'll probably be able to pledge for even less, to the point where if you wanted to, you could pledge 25 cents an episode. And if we do 4 episodes in a month, then through Patreon, you know, you'll get billed a dollar to help support us. Or you can go higher than that. And we'll have a couple of milestone goals in there where if we make, you know, X amount of money per month, maybe we'll do, you know, an extra episode, or we'll do some special other something else, a video or something. And again, you'll be able to see all of that. And we thought of a few different things as far as if people want to support us that they can do. And we just felt like doing the Patreon would be the best way to go. And if you would like to help us out, and the Patreon
and
thing,
you're not having the same problems we are.
Right. You know, if you want to help us out and the Patreon thing doesn't sound appealing to you, you can still go to hypernonsense.com/support. And we have the buttons there where you can donate through PayPal, Square Payments, or Bitcoin, and our mailing address is there. So if you want to send, you know, if electronic things don't work and you want to, you know, I don't know, send a check in the mail or a money order, or if you want to go and I'm deadly serious when I say this, if you want to go out and buy a Target gift card and mail it to us because you don't like electronic things, you can drop it in an envelope and mail it to us. It would help a lot.
We will use it for groceries.
That will buy our groceries. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's as good in our eyes as cash, and, you know, we got to eat. So any things that translate out to food are great. If, you know, you got a stockpile in your basement and you want to put a bunch of, throw a bunch of canned vegetables in a box,
send
you know,
it
our
over,
P.O. box
you know?
Is there. Yeah. You can mm-hmm. mail it. I think the expense on that, if you're, you know.
Yeah, I don't know what that would cost to ship, really. You'd have to decide for yourself if that's worth it to you, you know.
Might be more than it's worth, but, you know, I don't know. If you live, you know, not too far away from us, it might, you know, be, it might be less expensive than what you think would
yeah,
be worth
and it will
slapping
get
on a gift card.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I don't want to, you know, come off sounding, you know, super needy here, but
that's where
part of
at,
the reason
you know?
we went over this whole thing is to kind of explain that we're not just kind of doing this whole thing with the Patreon or whatever as kind of a toss off just to kind of go, hey, we'd like to make a little cash from our fun little show here.
Right.
You know, at this point, it really is about survival. So,
yeah. And yeah. That's really where it is, you know. And we do have we have a court date coming up for
yeah,
the
the way that bankruptcy works is you're in, and we did hire an attorney this time.
Oh yes,
we did get an attorney this time, and you know she put all our paperwork together and she sent a petition to the court. And that gives us a court hearing, which is at the end of December. So
it'll be after Christmas.
Yeah.
So Merry freaking Christmas to us, you know?
Yeah.
And I already hate the whole holiday season because of past traumas. So this is just going to be really fun for me, you know?
Based on everything we know, we don't really expect that to be any huge drama. But obviously we'll talk about that when the time comes now. There's not nothing else to say about it because
right.
it's in the future.
Right. So, I mean, and it seems to be formulaic and we have a good lawyer who's gotten everything prepared.
Yeah.
So it's kind of go in, do this, you're done, and you move on with life sort of
yeah.
thing. Yeah.
All right. So before we close this out, after all of that stuff, I think it would be good to try to have bring a little bit of humor to this whole thing. And I don't know if a lot of people heard this story, but I thought it was pretty funny. And I'm assuming that this publication I'm reading this from is based out of Canada, because the first sentence says, the U.S. equivalent of our Boxing Day sales, Black Friday, is basically a modern incarnation of hell. Which is true.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
People camp outside department stores to be first in line for sales. They then proceed to trample one another, yell, brawl over shitty TVs, and generally sacrifice small parts of their humanity for the sake of some stocking stuffers their extended family definitely don't want anyway. Here, Gawker made a compilation of this year's best fights, so you can watch. That's not really relevant, but anyway. It says, but this year, not all retail outlets were frothing over the opportunity to turn their customers into packs of growling, cash-spewing subhumans. Noted weirdos and professional shitsters, Cards Against Humanity, in fact, refused to sell any of their usual products. Instead, they had something special planned. Quote, to help you experience the ultimate savings on Cards Against Humanity this Black Friday, we've removed the game from our store, making it impossible to purchase. Post on their Facebook page read, instead, we're offering a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to buy some new bullshit. But unlike the general bullshit sold at Walmart or Best Buy or any other chain store that briefly became makeshift cage fighting arenas over the weekend, this stuff Cards Against Humanity was peddling was way more honest. It really was shit, bullshit like poo from a male cow. Though there are definitely easier ways to obtain poo than buying it online for $6 in a box with an emoji on it, people jumped at the opportunity. Within the day, they completely sold out. That's 30,000 people who are now willingly about to receive some poo on their front doorstep. And though they really couldn't have been more straightforward about it, some customers were still confused. To combat people's inevitable questions, a series of special FAQs were uploaded to the website during the day. When that failed to put people off, the Cards Against Humanity team took to Twitter to clarify, this isn't the first time Cards Against Humanity have purposefully disappointed their fans either. Last year, They ran a special surprise promotion where people were sent 12 days of holiday bullshit. 100,000 people signed up and were gifted with a whole bunch of things, including but not limited to little lumps of coal. This year, they're at it again, hosting a 10 days of Kwanzaa or whatever sale where everyone will get a swag of mystery junk for $15. In conclusion, people are weird. Now, this article does have, you know, some embedded tweets here from people who work for Cards Against Humanity. And one of them says, it's two tweets. This person says, people emailing us to ask, what is this? Is it really poop? I just bought it. Hope it's not poop. And the next tweet says, it's poop. here's a screen grab from a Reddit thread. Someone says, maybe the cards will be hidden inside the poop. Even though it's sterilized, you'd still have to wipe the poop off the cards. To which someone who presumably works for Cards Against Humanity responds and just says, nope.
It's nope.
someone else tweets, also from Cards Against Humanity, says, if you buy the poop expecting it to be something else that's not poop, you're actually buying a valuable life lesson for $6. So
well, they were pretty clear, you know, they're pretty clear, yeah, about what it was. Yeah. They've made it pretty obvious.
So yeah, I kind of like that as kind of a whole, you know, fuck you to the whole Black Friday thing, which is absurd.
It is absurd.
And I stayed home that whole day.
I don't go. Ever since I stopped working retail, I'm like, I'm not, you know, I used to have to work those days and I never want to go back ever again and put myself into that crowd. And I don't want to be there and have some other worker have to be there because I'm there. You know what I mean?
And the Wednesday, as I explained on the last show, the Wednesday before Black Friday was the day I ran into the guy that was trying to, you know, pick a fight with me on the street.
Right.
So mm-hmm. I just kind of went, you know what? I just don't need to go anywhere near downtown San Luis Obispo.
Yeah,
today.
Just stay away.
I just
that.
Don't need
yeah.
it.
Yeah. You know, the other thing with going to this, back to this Black Friday thing, from what I've seen on Twitter, it appears that the Black Friday thing has hit the UK.
Okay.
They don't have a Thanksgiving.
Right. Well, they don't have it in Canada either. And it's,
well, they have it. They do have. There. They do have a Canadian Thanksgiving, but it is not the same day as the American Thanksgiving. It's in October. So it seems odd that, you know, this Black Friday thing, which was supposed to be, well, you know, you have Thanksgiving off and then you have Friday off too. So why not have a sale kind of thing? It's just grown into this monster that's like happening in other countries that don't even have the holiday it was spawned from, you know? It's just weird to think about in a lot of ways. And I don't think this is going to be sustainable forever. I think it's going to all be Cyber Monday sales or whatever, which this year started a lot of stores. Now, I have to know this for one of the jobs I write for. I don't care about sales. I don't shop. But many of the stores this year started their Black Friday, Cyber Monday, whatever the hell sales on Halloween.
Yeah.
It's just nuts.
So anyway, do you got anything else you want to share in regards to whatever?
I think that's plenty for now. Yeah,
this show has definitely run long enough.
So, hey, you know, our life could be worse. We could have spent $6 for bullshit.
That's true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening. Hypernonsense.com is our website. And we'd love for you to go there and leave us some comments. You can email us show@hypernonsense.com. And actually, I'd really love for someone to just send a quick email, just a test email, to show@hypernonsense.com, because I recently changed how I handle all of my email addresses, and I'd like to get some email from, you know, outside of kind of the bubble of my own email accounts. You know, I can send test emails to myself all day, but that doesn't necessarily mean other people's emails are getting through. So if someone could just send a quick test email.
Really,
just says,
it can
hello.
Just say, hello, this is a test email. I hope you got it or something.
Yeah,
that's
would
fine.
Be fantastic. show@hypernonsense.com. You can follow us on Twitter @hypernonsense. And again, hypernonsense.com/support. We'd love for you to help us out if you can. And we'll have on that page, of course, the PayPal, Square, Bitcoin donation options, our P.O. Box addresses there. We'll also have the link to our Patreon campaign, but you'll also be able to find that hypernonsense.com/Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N. It'll take you straight over. Also, one thing I've completely forgot to mention, we now have a group on Google Plus.
Yes, really. We're not kidding.
Google Plus.
It exists.
The reason that we picked that one over Facebook is Jen doesn't use Facebook, and I wanted...
No, I do not use Facebook.
Yeah, I wanted a group that she could be a part of. So we've got about, I think, 6 or 7 members so far.
Which for us is pretty good, honestly.
But if you go to the website, you can see the link to the Google Plus group in the sidebar of the website, or you can also go to hypernonsense.com/subscribe, where you can see all the ways you can subscribe to the show, and there's a link there as well to the Google Plus group. So,
right, yes.
So thank you everyone for listening. We hope we haven't depressed you too much.
Well, if anything, your life must be better than ours this holiday season, so maybe we've uplifted you in a really strange, bizarre way, you know?
Maybe we've given you the dose of Schadenfreude you need to get you through the rest of the year. So thanks again for listening, and with any luck, we'll be back with you next week.
Bye, people. ¶¶